Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the right my good friend, John Doodle.
Hey, great to be back.
Yeah, good to see you, John. And on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, and listeners, hi. Hope you're doing okay.
Yeah, it's beautiful out there. I have loved the lower temperatures.
Slightly cooler weather.
Yeah, and I was in Sandy over the weekend, and I was just in my rearview mirror. I looked, and I could see the city way behind me.
Yeah.
And it just, the city's getting so much larger, more prominent.
Yeah.
And it just made me smile.
Well, good, good. We had some rain. Unfortunately, Sandy got hammered with the rain on, what was it, Thursday night?
Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah, but it makes for some beautiful sunsets and skies and all that. Okay, well, we got to go to Iran. The MOU has ended.
With no peace deal.
No peace deal. The United States looks increasingly compromised from my point of view, just not able to finagle something out of this.
Not willing to put boots on the ground.
Yeah.
But not able to finish it from air power, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to say it, John. And increasingly becoming a midterm threat to the Republican, you know, establishment.
Oh, yeah.
Because price is still high, gasoline's still high.
The mess in Iran, various folks are referring to Trump as Jimmy Carter II.
Okay.
Which he does not appreciate.
Yeah, for sure. Shireen, but then you also, people are pointing fingers at the left for not capitalizing on this and not getting where they need to get to.
Yeah. Classic problem on the left. I will say this, like it's interesting to really think about the impact that this is having on, for example, day-to-day Utahns who are really struggling to fill up their gas tanks to deal with the increasing costs and the uncertainty, to think about folks who may have family members in the military and like what that means, you know, that kind of uncertainty and fear. I think I've mentioned before, I have a friend who's serving on a base in Jordan. It was one that was attacked, you know, and like,
wow,
that is not that is this. This is because of the choices of our president. Gas prices are controlled by OPEC. But when you have this kind of conflict and this disruption in the market, the price driving up for everyday Utahns is because of Donald Trump. And I think it's just a absolute miss that we are not. People on the left, Democrats, are not talking about this every day.
Interesting.
I'm going to say this is a much bigger issue than Donald Trump. If you go back and look, I mean, we've been dealing with Iran for at least 47 years, if not you know, for a few decades before that. And so there's been these underlying issues in the Middle East and so forth. So, some will say that he took the bait and stepped in there when he was saying he wouldn't and he was going to avoid it. I think he and various folks in the administration thought this would be much quicker than it clearly is. And it's one of those histories, you know.
Well,
various presidents thought things would be much easier in the Middle East than they ever turn out to be.
Let's not forget the date you keep bringing up, 47, 48 years ago now, is absolutely tied to American arrogance in that region. Like, we created that problem starting in 1953.
This is the Shah.
Yes.
The Shah of Iran.
So I think it's important to understand the context. This is driven by a particular ideology in American politics that we get to decide who rules in certain places. I think we'll eventually see a similar fallout in Venezuela. We've seen it over and over again repeated around the world.
Meanwhile, you've got the USS Abraham Lincoln. I don't know how many days it's been out there, but the deteriorating conditions. You've got, you know, soldiers complaining about it, their families complaining about it. You've got the administration, at least from President Trump, denying it. But then you've got other military officials saying, actually, there's some mental health struggles. We've got to work through this. Not a good look.
Not a good look.
I don't think this is helping.
No, maybe Pete Hegseth could go and do some pull-ups with them. I mean, it really is such a it's such an absolute failure to address, I think. This is something I feel really strongly about. I am so grateful for the folks who are willing to serve this country. I think the way that we actually treat our soldiers, and especially upon return, is an absolute stain on how we perform as Americans.
So there's multiple things at play here. Clearly, we had a base that was really important for restocking that was bombed, and so therefore some supply chain disruptions. The other challenge is when sailors, in this case, are told you're going home in May, and then all of a sudden,
you're not.
It goes past and goes past, and it's open-ended. You've kind of set expectations. And so there's lots of things at play in this thing.
Yeah. You know, I have a nephew who, you know, grew up in this in the Salt Lake Valley, went to East High, found his way to the Air Force Academy, served an LDS mission in Brazil, came back, had to get readmitted to the Air Force Academy, went through everything, got his pilot's license, you know, became a pilot. Then he's assigned to one of those refueling jets. So he's been, you know, activated and is running 12-hour missions with three people on the plane. They alternate. And I just sort of, and he's married to another Air Force Academy graduate. And I'm just watching the sacrifice they make, the concern that the parents have. Makes it really real for me to see my little David Gochner in this kind of role. But
Well, this is one of those things. It's like, okay, some people think about war being, you know, oh, we can just do this and we can drone and it's really easy and quick and simple. And then when you start to layer in the individuals that are serving, the families that are impacted, the pressures and the risks that they're under.
Yeah, I worry.
It's a whole different perspective.
Yeah. I worry that there's too large of a gap between the people making decisions and the people affected by those decisions. And you can think of this pretty easily. You know, the Secretary of Defense, war, seems pretty detached.
Yep.
This is Secretary Hegseth. I don't know. You guys can weigh your own judgment about whether President Trump is. When I was in Washington, a common thing for leaders to do would be to go to the Walter Reed Medical Center and go see soldiers hurt in action. And that grounded you. And I hope that that's occurring. I mean, I hope that those in decision-making roles are doing that a bit.
I mean, I'll just say I don't think they are. And this is a place that was very personal to Joe Biden. You may remember on his like card each day that had his calendar on it, they also acknowledged, you know, what was happening in terms of people's lives lost in service of this country. I don't think that Trump is carrying around a similar card.
Yeah.
Well, President Trump does regularly show up when the bodies of our killed service members are arriving back in the States. And so he does have some, you know, appreciation or recognition of the sacrifices they've made.
And we're also aware simultaneously that they are not accurately reporting on the injuries or deaths. And that is, I think, a real disservice.
That's a big gap.
Yeah.
you know, when that's not happening. Yeah. But okay, I want to get to more hopeful, but one more thing, John, I want to capitalize.
But going back, I mean, are we going to see any resolution in the short term? No.
Sure,
I think this
like
is going to keep dragging on, dragging out, which means it's going to have a major impact on the midterm elections.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think if it was in and done and resolved, it would have been a whole different situation.
Yeah.
We are not there.
Yeah.
And we're in August.
It's interesting, though. We say that, and yet nothing's changed on the, you know, prevailing wisdom. That is that the Democrats will take the House and the Republicans will keep the Senate. I'm waiting for something to change there.
Yeah.
Hasn't yet.
Hasn't yet.
And the prevailing wisdom. John, I want to capitalize on your legal background. We've got the Supreme Court now rejecting an appeal from the Trump administration to find him liable for sexually abusing Jean Carroll. This is for the damages, I think. But the Supreme Court has once again said, nope, we're not gonna intervene here. You need to, this is, a civil complaint you got to go take care of.
Right. And they're probably not seeing any kind of split decision or anything like that clearly. And so they don't see a point of weighing in. And
so the $5 million judgment remains intact.
Remains. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Shireen, Caroline Leavitt?
Leavitt.
Stepping down.
Yes.
She was
press secretary.
Press secretary of the White House. She was blistering to reporters.
Yeah. So I think
she had no mercy. She just would call them out and ignore them and pick favorites. And
I've really been reflecting on this because I think there is a part of me that wants to say maybe one of the most skilled press secretaries.
She was good. Yeah.
However, she blatantly lied repeatedly to the American people and then weaponized dissent or vitriol against the press to basically distract from the, I would say, corruption at the heart of this administration, the incompetence. And she did a masterful job.
How about her being in that job, you know, 8-9 months pregnant?
Yeah.
My goodness. And and also, I really respect her for having this second child and stepping aside.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and despite her young age, I mean, 25, I think when she came in, she delivered for Trump. I think she was the press secretary that he wanted, and she masterfully performed what he was expecting from that job.
Yeah. You did note that he did leave her on the plane that was potentially going to be the target of an attack. I think I think for any mother, of course, that will give you second thoughts. But I think that she has really done an incredible job to continue to undermine trust in institutions. And I hope she's remembered for exactly what she did.
How about the Kennedy Center getting President Trump's name back on it again?
Yeah. So now the board has voted.
Yeah.
But basically what it will remain is the Kennedy, if I'm not mistaken, it will remain the Kennedy Center renovated by Donald Trump. So that's what it will say.
Is it going to be the White House renovated by Donald Trump?
Right.
I'm not one of those that's a fan of putting people's names on buildings, you know.
Yeah, but I got
especially when they're still alive. I mean, let history elapse, you know, and then determine if you're really going to put somebody's name on. But we look at, you know, over a few hundred years of names were there and names were taken off and so forth. I especially dislike putting anybody's name on when they're still living.
You set me up for this, John, because a big naming occurs this week. The North Building of the Capitol is going to be named the Michael Levitt Building, and I am over the moon about this. I'm so excited. Of course, he's still living. His parents are still living. And I think it would have been a crime to call that the North Building for 10 more years or 15 more years.
Did you just say his parents are still living?
Yeah, they are.
Wow, okay.
Anne and Dixie Levitt still living. And this is one of the things I love is they can be there for this.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I'm stunned.
Yeah.
Because he's not young.
Yeah, sure.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, he's the oldest in the family, and it was an early birth. I don't know, but
incredible.
I'm super excited about this. And I think what would have been a shame is to call this the North Capitol Building for X amount of years before naming it after this very worthy governor.
Well, that building, the predecessor building used to be called the SOB, the State Office
that's
Building.
That's a good line.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
that's
this will
right.
be an upgrade.
Yeah. Hey, well, let's take a short break. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned, everyone. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. That's BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. We're kind of chippy today, having a good time in studio. Love our producer, Anthony Scoma.
Oh.
He's
yes.
amazing, right?
Yes. Well, we were just revisiting this off air, but I do think there is something incredible about this show that all three of you, you, John, you, Natalie, and he, come from families of 11.
Exactly 11. Not big families.
John's
families
with
the,
11. Oldest
I'm the oldest
in his. Anthony and I think, are both youngest in ours. So
it's amazing.
And then Shireen.
Now, I will say, so one and done at my house.
You need 10 adopted?
Yeah, right. I tried. I always was hanging out with big families. In fact, I just went back to North Dakota to be with my best friend in high school as her mom passed. And it was incredible to be back in that house because they were a big Catholic
wow.
family,
mm-hmm.
family of six. And I always tried to just become number 7.
Yeah. I had a little bit of that because being the youngest of 11, by the time you come around, especially with LDS missions, you know, brothers leaving, kids going away to school.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt like an only child at times. And I latched onto some families for sure.
So yeah. My youngest sister was born 6 weeks before I went to college. And I used to joke, I grew up in Portland and the Catholic family had 13 that was in the neighborhood. So we weren't even the biggest family.
Yeah, well, isn't that something?
Now, this is interesting because just a couple weeks ago, there was yet another look in the New York Times at the dropping fertility rate mm-hmm. in Utah. And I know this is mm-hmm. something you've studied, mm-hmm. Natalie, and it's really interesting to me to think about, I mean, I work in reproductive health, and to really think about the sort of really, I would say, strong kind of resurgence of this whole tradwife thing that's happening very much online, very mm-hmm. much kind of influencing people to get off of birth control, sort of all of those issues. And then at the same time, the reality on the ground is that Utahns are having smaller families.
Yeah.
And to see people really talk about how important it is for them to be able to plan and space their families as they see fit, which is something that really aligns with the LDS kind of belief.
Well, the Deseret News was having an article talking about at BYU.
Yeah.
Marriage rates are falling.
Falling.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting trends happening.
They
are.
There sure are. And these are all personal decisions, but from a macroeconomic perspective, we will pay a price for having fewer children.
Yeah.
In my judgment. So.
How so? I mean, well, I know there's economic issues and social issues, but talk to me a little bit more.
Youthful populations are tech savvy.
Uh-huh.
They're inexpensive. They're healthy.
Yeah. Lower healthcare costs.
Yeah. They really feed into some, you know, fundamental economic advantages. We call it our demographic cushion in Utah, since we still have it because our fertility rate's higher than in many other states. But it creates a growing workforce. It creates a young and healthy workforce, a tech savvy workforce. It makes us attractive.
Okay. Yeah. And I was looking at it more from, you know, when you have kids and grandkids, you care more about the future
there
than
some
oftentimes
of
if you don't. because you're wanting them to have hopefully a better life than you had.
I tell you, having a grandson has changed me for sure, because I'm really keyed into what his world's going to be like.
Yeah.
I want it to be the best it can be.
Yeah.
Yeah. The innocence of these, of my grandson, Jetty, and the potential, the possibility for him makes me want to do better public policy.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I believe that. Well, we got some
It's fun being grandma.
It is. We got some new poll numbers in. So let's talk about them.
Yeah.
These are approval ratings. I don't know. We can study the poll, but pretty much across the board, our elected officials are being downgraded.
Yeah.
And up top of mind is Governor Cox.
Yeah. So this is Deseret News reporting. And
Brigham Tomko, the reporter, political reporter.
I lose track, but I think they do this about every 6 months. So the last data point that we have is from January. And since then, I'm doing this from memory. Please correct me. But I think that Governor Cox has seen a 10-point drop in his popularity. He was right at the margin, about 50% approval rating.
This is strongly approved. 51, it's dropped to 41. Yep. So you're right on.
Has dropped to 41. And that is a big drop. And I guess I'm curious what you two think is driving that.
I'm not sure, but I know Senator Wyler thinks it's how the data center issue was handled and rolled out and maybe not rolled out well, that people felt like they weren't being involved, that they were getting blindsided by this issue, that the magnitude of the acreage, the magnitude of the energy consumption was just shocking so many folks.
Yeah.
But I know he attributes some
of it
to that.
He attributes it to that. I mean, I'm not going to forget. Well, I rarely do forget when Governor Cox really...
Oh, Shereen
really,
rarely forgets.
I mean, what an elephant, you know. But, you know, I think he really dismissed people in a way that was antithetical to his entire persona around Disagree Better. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a huge disappointment and also just really politically quite stupid. But I also think that there was this kind of sense of feeling like when we ignore people's fears and don't do the good work, and I think you've been trying to do it here, of like educating people about how these systems are changing. A mega data center is one thing, but to think about really the water impact, to think about the energy impact, to think about the heat impact in the valley, I think there are real concerns. And to acknowledge those and try to educate and bring people along is not what I saw him doing. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Natalie?
Well, a couple things I'd point out. This is coming from being in a governor's office for so many years. But, you know, there's a strongly approved measure and then there's a somewhat approved measure. And if you tally up those two, he's at 68%. That's about, I mean, the 70s is where governors normally are. Sometimes they get as high as 80. But he's at 68%, either somewhat approved or strongly approved. I think that's still okay. I just put that out for our listeners.
I would say if you're getting up to 80 or mid-80s, you're not doing a good job as governor because you're not making the hard decisions you need to make.
Yeah. So anyway, I just want to give him the benefit of saying that there's 27% somewhat approved and 41 plus 27 gets you that 68.
One of the other things I think coming in play, and this isn't about Governor Cox, but I think it's you see it nationwide. You also see it in Utah. It's just lots of folks are agitated, irritated at their elected officials for various reasons.
Yeah.
And we don't know how to effectively engage and discuss our disagreements. Mm-hmm. And so we just think they're all evil for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't matter political party or it doesn't matter where you are in the political spectrum. It's just becoming a bigger and bigger societal concern from my perspective.
Yeah. I think the data center argument is certainly, we saw what it did to a Senate president in our state, certainly the state of our world. And I'm talking about grumpy economy or an uneven economy or a economy that isn't working for everyone.
K-shape.
Affordability. But maybe we should just be talking about how people are unhappy right now.
Yeah.
And I can reflect in my own life. This has been the last year and a half have been one of the hardest years of my life. Just some things I'm working through. But you take whatever you might have in the personal side and then combine it with what you might have on the economic, financial, economic side. And then you put it with the state of our world. And, you know, I'll be critical here, but a president who wants to bomb the SHIT out of Oman that's been an ally to ours and been helping to negotiate this for us.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel good.
No.
Yeah.
No. And
I notice I don't say the word. I can't do
I
it.
I know. Look at you. Guys,
I can't do
you
it.
Are so good. but I think it's important to note that Cox isn't the only one who suffered in this poll, that both Curtis and Lee are also down. And the article supposes that just the influence of Donald Trump and what he has created in terms of vibes in this country are contributing to that.
Yeah.
I think some of the vibes also go back to the COVID and the experience people had and the disconnect and struggling to reconnect post-COVID.
Listen, the fact that COVID put us in a situation where we, instead of having how many MMR vaccines to make them six, what was it?
Yeah.
One went to six. You know this issue, Sharon?
Yeah, it's a good question.
I just heard it on Meet the Press, but it was basically this idea that what the president did in executive order that separated the MMR into separate shots. Right. And so you have to go back six times right. to get fully vaccinated.
And it was less effective because people don't go back.
Yeah. And yeah. And I'm just sort of like, COVID gave us that? And I come from the perspective, I'm using your words there, John, mm-hmm. of a father that was a pediatrician. And he praised vaccines for what he saw it do for polio and different yeah. things during his lifetime. So well, the state of our world's just messy right now.
Also worked health department, right, back in
yeah,
D.C.?
Yeah, I was at HHS. So. It went, back then it wasn't even questioned. I mean, everything was about, I mean, every once in a while I'd go to the Humphrey Building at HHS and there'd be people out there with posters on the you know, vaccines and what it's doing with, you know, different, I mean, just... It's just not fair. The evidence isn't there to show the autism and things like
yeah.
that.
I'll just add, too, I saw the Washington Post has an article right now live that is showing dropping vaccine rates, specifically MMR, across this country. And it was so interesting to me to look at Utah, where every county has seen a decline. You can you can probably guess which ones have the fastest drop. There is one exception, and that exception is, what is this county? It might be Tooele. Because Tooele County goes all the way out to the border, correct? Like all the way out to Wendover?
Yep, Nevada, yeah.
That one has had an increase. Every other one has had a decrease.
Hey, just back to the Cox thing for 1 minute. I thought it was worth mentioning. But this Michelle Tanner, who's the St. George City Councilwoman, was quoted in the Brigham Tomco article in the Deseret News as saying, this is about Governor Cox. When you try to appease everyone, you end up appeasing no one. And there is some sense out there that this governor has tried to... please everyone and has flip-flopped.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that, but there's a sentiment of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is.
So
I don't have to give my examples. We can move on.
Let's do it. Do you want to talk about, I don't know, mail-in voting or weighing in on voter ID in elections?
Yeah. So really quickly, I thought that this voter ID, we've talked about this a few times, but I just want to be really clear. 95% of Utahns vote by mail. They love it. Mm-hmm. And this is pretty consistent across primaries and in general voting. But this piece of reporting that I thought was interesting says, in two of Utah's most sparsely populated counties, Emory and Garfield, every vote came via post or was left in a drop box. So that is how people are voting. So when we think about our president attacking vote by mail, a state he wins over and over again. And, well, I should say, I'm not so sure about Emory, but Garfield is a blow up for mm-hmm, Trump. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want people to have that luxury, though he's happy to take it to vote by mail in Florida. There's really, I think, a lot of concern happening there. The other thing that I thought was interesting. Oh, go ahead. I was just going to talk about this voter ID.
One quick thing there.
Yeah.
As we shift more towards vote by mail or the drop box, I think we have fewer polling places. And so that's also weighed in. For me, it's not as convenient to show up at the polling place because they're not running the same hours in the same locations. So that's just something to also remember.
Yeah, that there are gives and takes because people aren't fully funding. I remember this when I was on the county council. It's expensive to run elections. And then we get these different mandates or, you know, there has to be added security at drop boxes or whatever. Counties have to eat that. And I think for a county of the first class, Salt Lake County, it's not the biggest deal. It's still a challenge. But you think about some of these counties where, you know, 10,000 people live, fewer. That's a lot of cost.
Yeah.
Well, and for a guy like me, it's maybe 5 minutes, you know, 2 miles to the polling place versus out in rural parts of Utah, you're driving half an hour to an hour each way just to get there.
Yeah.
Maybe longer.
John, what about the showing of voter ID? Well, showing of a birth certificate or passport when you register to vote. We've seen some polling on this. 66% of Utah voters say they support this proof of U.S. citizenship when you register to vote.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I totally agree with that. I think we need to prove that we're citizens to vote. I have some concern when you have to show photo ID that's issued by the government. I want to make sure there's other ways that you can prove that you're a citizen, but I think it's critical that we make sure that we prove we're citizens to vote. One other thing I would throw in there is I don't like that the federal government has mandated to states that you can, when you get your license, register your vehicle, and then you also... if you will, register to vote. I think that causes too many issues and confuses some folks that aren't citizens that think that they can sign up this other thing, maybe not recognizing that mm-hmm. it's actually registering to vote, and that's improper for them.
Big split here between Republicans and Democrats.
Shereen. Yes, and I would just say, there are elements of what you're saying that make total sense to me. I believe that passports should be much more affordable. The process should be easier. I think obtaining your birth certificate should also be a lot easier. It can be quite difficult for folks. And so really thinking about what it would mean from a systemic level to improve access, and I think we should all be concerned when we have an agenda to reduce your access to the ballot, whoever is advancing it.
Yeah. I don't mind the one time showing of you know, your status. I just don't want to do it on the day of a vote. You know, yeah. I don't mind it to register, but once you're registered, I want it to be as easy as possible.
Okay. After that.
But how do I know you are who you say you are?
You audit it afterwards and see if you have problems, and we don't.
And we don't.
But we drop it into a box and we can't pull it out.
Yeah. Hey, this is a wrap. I know our producer will be happy that I'm ending it now. Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shereen Gourbani. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody.